Welcome to the podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. Our podcast weaves together the message and a taste of the music that we experience each Sunday morning as we root our lives in grace through worship here at The Table. More and more people are finding their way to The Table through this podcast, so if you are one of the many, many folks who tune in each week from other parts of California, other parts of our country, or even from other places in the world, we would invite you to take a next step in growing in faith here at The Table. You can do that online at our website, thetableumc.org. There you'll find links to social media and also a way to make a deep commitment to our community to express how you hope to root your life in grace, to grow in faith, to reach in love, and to give generously. If you're one of the many people listening to this but haven't quite walked through the door of the sanctuary yet on a Sunday morning, we would love to welcome you into the beauty of this sanctuary. We gather each Sunday for worship at 9:30 and at 11. Our address is 5265 H Street in East Sacramento.
I went the ways of wayward winds in a world of trouble and sin, walked along in crooked mile behind a million rank and file. Forgot where I came from, somewhere back when I was young. I was a good man's child. 'Cause I lost some nameless things, my innocence flew away from me. She had to hide her face from my desire to embrace forbidden fire. But at night I dream, she's singing over me. Oh, oh, my child, come on home, home to me, and I will hold you in my arms, and joyful be there will place for you at my table. Return to me.
Some of you follow us in social media, so will make sense to you every week, and some of you get emails from us. So every week, almost every week, Matt sends an email out just saying a little bit about what to expect in church on Sunday, and so and then that gets also posted on Facebook. So we did that this week, as we often do, usually do. We posted our weekly email yesterday morning letting people know that today we would be focusing in worship on privilege. And something kind of shocking happened within just a few hours. See, usually when we do that and the email hits Facebook, it generates one like. Maybe two, but like hardly ever. Just one like. And yesterday, within just a few hours of us sending out, we had five likes. And that may not sound it, but Tawny knows that's like a big difference, right? One or five? That's huge. So, we thought, lots of folks must want to put privilege on the table. Then the unsubscribes started rolling in. And I want you to know that, like, over maybe 2-3 months' time, we will get one unsubscribe to our email list. Yesterday, within that same period of time, we had five people unsubscribe to our email. Ouch. Putting privilege on the table clearly pushes some folks to dismiss themselves from the meal. So, here's the deal. We're going to try to talk about privilege this morning. And that means talking about whiteness, about wealth, about gender, about sexuality, about able-bodiedness, and that's just a short list of the long list that could be talked about. Because privilege is interconnected and intersectional. And I've probably already just now lost some of you and made some of you tune out just already now. Because when some of us hear privilege, we immediately feel accused. And that, I think, is because we conflate privilege with prejudice and bigotry. We don't see ourselves as prejudiced, and we certainly don't feel like we're bigots. That's how we are. And mistakenly, we conflate those two. And that is not what I'm going to put on the table today. Over the last couple weeks, I've had conversations with a number of folks in our community about this. And I have also gone back to a scholar who has enriched my life and learning over the years. Her name is Bell Hooks. And she's an African-American feminist scholar who was recently interviewed. And her reflections really helped me put this message together. And more importantly, I think, to think more faithfully and critically about privilege. Bell Hooks was a professor at Yale and at Oberlin College. So that tells all of us that she totally made it academically. She climbed the ladder to the top, and she is a success, capital S. And then she left all of that to teach in a poor urban college in New York City. And here's some of what she writes. She said, "My students were equally brilliant in both of those locations, but their sense of agency was different. Those who were primarily white had a sense of a future. Those in the urban setting, which was predominantly students of color, did not. Having a future equals privilege." Professor Hooks would, she said, meet her students at City College in New York, and she would meet with them in her office, and they would pour out their hearts to her. And she wanted them to know that they had a future. She said she witnessed day in and day out their hopelessness, their fear that life is without meaning, their profound loneliness, and their lovelessness. These are college students. Young, bright, beautiful students came into her office and confessed regularly feelings of despondency. And she said she began to feel that she was irresponsible if she just sat and listened and commiserated with their woes without daring to share how she herself had confronted similar issues in her own life. Because they wanted to know, how did she sustain herself through that big climb she made? How did she keep on keeping on? And she said she had to learn to be open to talking about her spiritual life. She wanted, as a person who identifies as Christian, and Christian influenced, and she also says she feels shaped by mindfulness and Buddhism, to help these young people who felt marginalized in almost every way imaginable, that she knew absolutely, without a doubt, that they were beloved children of God. And this was not one of her academic responsibilities. She wasn't actually supposed to do it this way. It's so moving to me, and when you hear her talk about it. But as a person committed to her spiritual life and Christianity, she longed for these young people to know that no matter how much they lacked in terms of privilege in the world in which they lived. They were absolutely 100% beloved children of God, and beloved community was God's destiny for them. It's just so moving to me.
Just Linda, take a breath. Just take a breath. Because I can feel that you're on the verge of going to that place. And we felt you go to that place before. Emotional thing where the tears come up and it gets a little bit overwhelming. And
but it's real.
Privilege is really, really complicated. So I want to make sure that we don't kind of move so much into the feelings that we're not going to be able to kind of keep figuring this out, like with some reason.
Oh, really?
And some, yeah, I think that it's just, we need to be a little bit careful, not just letting some of the feelings get
so
strong.
You don't think feelings have a place in this? And emotions shouldn't play roles in our, like, experience of rooting our lives in grace and growing in faith? Seriously, Smith?
I think that they could. I think that they can. I think they do, even. But I also think that there's, like, these are really divisive topics. And I really think that it's important for us to kind of nail down some positions without letting ourselves get emotional about this or to feel some of those things,
right?
Like just to stay
right,
a little more
in
the logic,
like,
or the reason.
When Peter in the Bible, really, you're going to say that to me? Like when Peter in the Bible, the apostle who had, do you remember him? I don't know.
I'm very
who had a
Peter,
special
thank
call
you.
To ministry, and he was with the earliest Jewish followers of Jesus.
Yes, I'm aware.
Acts 15. I think you've read it. He used his privilege there to take to task the elders coming from Judea who were pushing, get ready now, circumcision, all right, on non-Jewish Christians.
Right, that's why we need to keep this focused, though, on privilege.
You don't think he had to appeal to men's feelings and emotions, just their reason and their logic?
Maybe a little.
Because 1,800 years before the invention of aseptic surgery, they had circumcision, Matt. Hmm. Ow. Maybe you can imagine the feelings or emotions that might have come up at that time.
When
a room full of Gentile men heard the religious authorities of the day tell Peter this. This is what they said. We have to circumcise the Gentile converts. You must make them keep the law of Moses. In other words, those grown men had to be circumcised. All doesn't mean all if you're not circumcised.
Do you have to keep saying circumcised?
Yes. I just want to make clear that no appeal to feelings or emotions were in that at all, you don't think? Nothing at all?
Maybe a little bit.
I think the apostles and the leaders probably called a special meeting to consider the matter. And that's really what they did. And the arguments went back and forth and on, getting more and more heated. And then Peter took the floor, as he used his privilege position, to say all means all. And he said this, "Friends, you well know that from early on, God made it quite plain that God wanted the Gentiles to hear the message of this good news and embrace it. And not in any secondhand or roundabout way, but firsthand, straight from my mouth. And God, who can't be fooled by any pretense on our part, but always knows a person's thoughts, gave them the Holy Spirit exactly as God gave the Holy Spirit to us. God treated the outsiders exactly as God treated us, beginning at the very center of who they were and working from that center outward, cleaning up their lives as they trusted and they believed. So why are you now trying to out-God God, loading these new believers down with rules, he said, that crushed our ancestors and the rules that crush us too? Don't we believe that we are saved because the Master Jesus amazingly and out of sheer generosity moved to save us as he did those from beyond our nation? So what are we arguing about?" So did you hear that, Matt?
Hear what?
That was like Peter's drop the mic moment. Yeah. And as our... you know, happens in drop the mic moments, there's this silence, kind of like right now. And in that silence, when he said that, I think the tears and the emotions and the feelings of the men in the room who had just heard a person with positional authority stand up and use their privilege to say no need to make either the young men or the old men bleed to earn salvation. And he said, from that vantage point of authority, for God, all means all. See, the Gentiles were new to following Jesus. And Peter, he could have kept going in another way and shut them all down. He could have risen to affirm his own privilege. He could have kept the status quo going. He could have created God in his own image. I think it would have been a lot easier for him not to ruffle the feathers, you know, and make people emotional.
Right,
and the
but I was just trying to, I was trying to not go into some of these personal places with this. I was trying to keep this a little bit more kind of reasonable. I was trying to mansplain a few things.
You just love to do that.
It happens occasionally, unfortunately. But as we're putting privilege on the table, I just want us to be able to hold that this is so complicated, not to get off on some of this circumcision stuff.
Yeah. Well, the Bible itself is enmeshed in complicated power dynamics. And privilege is always intersecting from different angles in the Bible. So putting things like privilege on the table means putting all of this on the table. Like the fact that the male writers of these documents were worried about circumcision, but the ancient female voices who were put off in a tent because we're on our periods, you know, rarely do our voices even make it into the Bible.
The Red Tent's been written about that. It's
okay,
a very good novel.
I'm not writing it.
But so those are definitely issues of privilege, but it's a big reason that I want to be a part of a church that's going to say, let's, even though it's uncomfortable, let's put this on the table and to try to talk about these things and to try not be afraid. But I really want to try to go back to what I was trying to say before. So if I could
Right.
Just...
So you can use your privilege today in the ways that biblical writers often unconsciously did in that time. Too. That's what you're trying to do right now.
Wasn't trying.
I know. But here's what I also know about you, Matt Smith. You have a daughter. She's 6 years old. And I am absolutely confident that you are not and will not ever be okay with her voice and her story being silenced.
That is very true. And it's in part... why we call the message of Jesus good news. For something to be news, it means it has to relate to our real lives, to who we are in this very moment. It's not just good history that Jesus brought, but it's good news about this very day. And the good news gets really, really complicated really, really quick as we start to reflect on privilege and relationship to it. On Thursday, Linda and I went down and we were teaching over in Berkeley. And then on the way back, I went to visit with a young person from our community who asked me to come and see her. She works as her day job. And this for me is just this reminder of how complicated this becomes so quickly. Her day job is working with homeless teenagers here in Sacramento, trying to help them learn some of the life skills to move from surviving to thriving. And she wanted me to come, and because after she's done with that day job, she's been going down in the evenings to camp with folks outside of City Hall to try to raise awareness about ordinances that our city has that prevents homeless folks from sleeping or even carrying a sleeping bag in the city of Sacramento. And so I showed up, and actually you might be proud of me. I showed up and did my best to just try to be present and to listen to this young white woman who is queer and just out of college and has felt led by Jesus to reach in love in some really radical ways. To actually take everything that she has and to put it in a backpack and to head down to City Hall and to stay there with folks. And she was reflecting on what it's been like for her as a housed person to be welcomed by unhoused people outside of City Hall. And I found myself immediately starting to wonder about some of the privileges that I hold and wondering about how I might be helpful to reach in love to those who are on the margins in our own society. And I never really thought so much about having a house as part of my privilege. I had a pretty long list of all the ways that I walk into this space as a privileged person, but the house wasn't really on that list, to be honest. And as I learned about these city ordinances that are preventing unhoused folks from sleeping in public places or even from carrying their sleeping bag, Like that in and of itself is giving folks a citation. It just started to raise the awareness of how cyclical these problems are. And I went to this place of overwhelm. See, my impulse, and this is true down there, and it's true a lot in my life, I think it's born out of my own identity as a straight white man. Part of the way that I find to love other people is to try to solve problems. And often I think it comes from the best place of who I am. I want to care for folks, for everyone and everything around me. And that's what it looks like for me to love. And the complexity of privilege and reaching in love in ways that embody the radical love of God get really overwhelming as you're standing in front of a person who's been sleeping on the streets and is being arrested for simply carrying a sleeping bag to try to stay warm when they're in that space. I was aware as I was down there, well, communities of faith are trying to respond to this crisis. Here in this very space, we welcomed folks not very long ago, just a few weeks ago, 100 or so unhoused folks came here for Winter Sanctuary. And then what I started to reflect on was the truth of so many of those folks that walked in our door this year were the same people that walked in the door 5 years ago when we did it for the very first time. And it's pretty overwhelming to see somebody coming back over and over and over and over and over again. It doesn't feel like the Band-Aids that we have are really doing a lot to create anything much better in terms of the realities that people are facing. And then I found myself feeling really grateful for people like Jen and Melissa, so many folks in our community who've made it their lives, their vocations, to try to address the complexity of all these things. The person from our church who's been down there these last couple weeks, she started to share with me about an experience that she'd had just two or three nights before. And what she was, what was happening was the police had shown up and they were starting to give citations. And the protesters, the folks who are unhoused, who are there at City Hall, they started to get angry and they started to lose control out of everything. And they definitely weren't coming from a place of love, is what I was hearing in her describe it. And things got pretty contested and it felt really dangerous. And what I started to reflect on as she was telling this story of everybody anger just like rising up there was a mentor of mine in the South Bronx, Alexi Torres Fleming. And Alexi taught us in the Bronx in her work in community organizing. She always would invite us together before we'd go to City Hall. She'd say, we got to sit down and we are here because we love our community. And that's why we're going to go present. That's why we're going to go talk about these issues because they're tearing us apart. And we're doing that from a place of love. And so we have to root ourselves in that love because anger is never going to win, is what Alexi would say. We have to come from a place of love. Anger just has everybody shut down instead of opening up, and then no one is really set free. There's a Croatian theologian, Miroslav Volf, he talks about it like this. We should formulate our political visions in the light of God, not construct our image of God in light of our political views. And for me, that's what Alexi was calling us to do, was to root our activism, the desire to make social change in the love of God. That was where Alexi was trying to help me to live in those young people. And it seemed really faithful, maybe even a little bit wise, to tell this young 20-something down there at City Hall that following in the ways of Jesus to make those changes mean we're going to have to root ourselves first in love, and anger is something we're going to have to turn away from, to let go of, to stay in that. And then I read when I got home, just back to my house, the privilege of that space. I read the text from Mark 3, and I heard it in a very different way. And then I wanted to have a chance to go back and talk to that young activist again because I think I could have done a little bit better. So.
Well, let me read it again then. Let's listen again. Again, Jesus entered the synagogue, and a man was there who had a withered hand. And they watched him to see whether he would cure him on the Sabbath so that they might accuse him. And he said to the man who had the withered hand, "Come forward." Then he said to them, "Is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath, to save life or to kill?" But they were silent. And he looked around at them with anger, and he was grieved at their hardness of heart, and said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." And he stretched it out, and his hand was restored. And the Pharisees went out and immediately conspired with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him.
And so when I came back to that, I started to wonder, maybe anger and love aren't opposites after all. Archbishop Desmond Tutu in South Africa says it this way: if you're neutral in situations of injustice, you've chosen the side of the oppressor. If an elephant has its foot on the tail of a mouse, and you say that you're neutral, the mouse will not appreciate your neutrality. And so maybe we can follow Jesus in allowing our love for those that are marginalized, like that man with the withered hand that Jesus restored to health. And in their day, what that meant, restoring to health, meant restoring that person to community, restoring that person to being together with everyone else. See, in Jesus' day, the religious leaders were silent. And Jesus' love for welcoming all, including the man with the withered hand, fueled an anger for him at those whose hearts had hardened. That's simply what Jesus found as he saw folks turn simply away. And so it made me question, how do we know when we're being neutral? Like, how do we know if we have our foot on the tail of a mouse? It doesn't always feel clear to me when that's actually happening.
I was reading this week, too. Ched Myers wrote about this passage, and he lifted up a book by Andre Trocmé in his, it was called Jesus and the Nonviolent Revolution. And in that book, he argues that this very episode that we are hearing about from Scripture is the turning point of Jesus's public ministry and represents carefully staged political theater. Jesus could, presumably, heal the man with that withered hand in a private place, right? Without provoking any kind of undue upset, emotion, or feeling. But instead, Jesus chooses to force the issue, he said, with the glare of media lights. He is not neutral here. And under that glare, with the hostile officials hovering, just waiting for Jesus to cross the line, the gospel writer of Mark finally resolves the question, which they were debating, of whether to heal on the Sabbath or not. And as in the modern practice, we would call civil disobedience, which might break a law in order to raise deeper issues of its morality and purpose. So then Jesus, just before crossing the line, issues a challenge to his audience, pitting his mission of compassion and justice to the poor against the imperatives of the dominant order. Jesus puts privilege right then and there on the table. He calls elephants to remove their feet from the tail of mice. And I think it's noteworthy and unique that we hear a description of the ruling elite's obstinance here in this translation is literally stubbornness of heart. Stubbornness of heart. But lest we allow ourselves to immediately be called into the blame game as if we wouldn't have behaved that way and become smug about it, I want us to know that this exact same charge will eventually soon be leveled at the disciples who follow Jesus as well. See, it's not always obvious to us when our feet are on someone else's tail. The man's hand is healed, the line is crossed, and immediately those local officials take counsel to put Jesus to death.
When privilege is disrupted in Jesus' day, and it feels like in every day, trouble ensues. That always is what happens next. So elephants aren't pleased when we're told that we need to watch our step. We like to just step wherever we're stepping. The Pharisees went out and they immediately conspire with the Herodians. And for a lot of us in here, we don't know the Herodians from the Pharisees, so that doesn't mean a whole lot to us. But in their day, what that meant was a Herodian was one that was with Herod. So Herod was on top of the dominant order. So if they're going to go out with the Herodians, they're going to go and find those that are on top of the social order of their day, and they're going to conspire together with them. The folks in would have heard this message would have known that John the Baptist would already have been taken in. So this is a very, very dangerous thing to conspire with these folks. These are the people that were deciding who was going to be imprisoned, and it meant that Jesus was going to follow in the way of John the Baptist. interrupting privilege meant that he too was going to have his life taken, just as John the Baptist was. See, as their privilege is called into question, they run away from the table because they can't handle losing their power and the knowledge that they hold. The Pharisees begin to plan for the execution of Jesus. It happens right there in this very moment of chapter 3 of Mark. The seed was planted as privilege was disrupted in a sanctuary on a Sabbath. The Pharisees were filled with fury against Jesus because he had violated all of the ways that they understood God to be moving through the laws of Moses. And more than that, he had claimed that he was the Lord of the Sabbath. That meant that he was one with God, and that to them was utterly blasphemous. So Jesus challenges their privilege and calls everyone to root their lives in grace by following the one that Jesus was showing us how to be.
Not just this passage, but Scripture gives us examples of the ways a community might disrupt privilege to bring about justice. And see, Jesus knew this. He lived this. He had studied the Torah, and he knew, for example, Leviticus 25, that is where we find privilege disrupted directly. It talks about Jubilee, and it says, "Consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee to you. Each of you is to return to your family property and to your own clan." It's pushing the reset button in this text to outline in great detail, and it goes on for verse after verse, of all the ways the people were to redistribute wealth and privilege that had been taken from people.
But it isn't always just directly that the Bible invites us to challenge or disrupt privilege. We find another example in John 8 of Jesus doing this in a very indirect and powerful, for me at least, way. See, there are swarms of people that have come to Jesus. And this is the translation that comes to us from Eugene Peterson, who's a Presbyterian pastor. Swarms of people came to Jesus. And Jesus sat down and taught them. The religion scholars and the Pharisees led in a woman who'd been caught in an act of adultery. They stood her in plain sight of everyone and said, "Teacher, this woman was caught red-handed in the act of adultery. Moses in the law gives orders to stone such persons, so what do you say?" They were trying to trap Jesus into saying something incriminating so that they could bring charges against them. So Jesus bends down and writes with his finger in the dirt. They kept at him, badgering him. He straightened up and said, "The sinless one among you, go first. Throw the first stone." Now, this is an interruption of privilege. Throw the first stone. Bending down again, Jesus stays there in the dirt and writes some more. Hearing that, he could hear the feet as he's just playing in the dirt of folks walking away. The oldest goes away first, and the woman was left there alone. And Jesus stood up and spoke to her, "Woman, where are they? Does no one condemn you?" "No one, Master. Neither do I," said Jesus. "Go on your way. From now on, don't sin." That is disrupting privilege. That's saying, quit looking at the one that you're telling me to look at and look inward at your own self. What is it that you bring to this mess? You're going to tell me you're any better than that one? That is sly, as Linda said it last week. Sly like a fox, Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Because Jesus forced folks back then to think about their own lives. And I think we might name this as a way of self-interrogation. Jesus seems to demand that we not just look at the supposedly sinful woman, but that we look at ourselves, starting with the oldest. That means, like me, I need to look at how my own whiteness, blondness in the world allows me to move in really different ways than women of color. I need to see how my straightness means I don't have to question PDA ever. That's public demonstration of affection for my husband. That's what PDA means. I present as a woman, so I don't have to worry ever about what bathroom I'm going to use. It's really obvious to me. I have a savings account. I have a mom I can turn to. She's in this room. I have a safety net because of that, that countless other people don't have. I don't have to worry about getting out my wheelchair out of a van that I had to apply to get funds to drive or to buy because I'm less able-bodied than the rest of humanity. And I don't have to worry to try and get up the steps of the church into Fireside Room where often we have food when it's cold outside. I'll never have to worry about that. And when my son, my 22-year-old son, gets pulled over by the police on his way back across town from work where he cleans the gym at 2 o'clock in the morning, I tend to trust they are just making sure Harrison is safe on his way home. And I certainly am not afraid they are going to take his life. In her writing and speaking, Bell Hooks uses a phrase that's really helpful, I think, and I'm going to share it with you. It's this: imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist patriarchy. And she uses this phrase to describe the structure that underlies our social order. Now, some folks hear this and just feel they're being called prejudiced. And it might have just happened just a minute ago. It feels too much, this phrase. It feels too blaming. But what Bell Hooks is naming is that domination and oppression are connected and they are tied together. We can't escape the ways that they shape our lives, all of us. One is not bigger than another. They are all connected. And locating ourselves within her phrase, imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist patriarchy, can pinpoint for us our privilege or our lack of privilege pretty quickly. Recently, Professor Hooks was asked just how she thought our nation could bring an end to white supremacy. And here's what she answered. We would all need to learn to love justice more than our race, more than our class, more than our sexuality, or any other identity aspect of us. Justice, she said, requires of us to honor principles of ideal rightness. We must all have hope that God's love is for all people, and that our lives can be lived in creative partnership with God to bring out love and justice for all God's people. There is, she said, so much anger, pain, and suffering. And the national dialogue around us seems to revolve over and over and over again around blame. Blame the victim. Blame the police. Blame the politicians. Blame the poor. Blame the rich. Blame is just simply not useful. The focus must be on accountability and not blame, along with recognition of our own agency. And my words now, not Professor Hooks, I believe that this is what Jesus was trying to do that day in the temple. Jesus is clearly angry. And he really sees their hardness of heart. But he chooses to focus on healing on the margins. He could have just blamed everyone standing around there for being blind and not even noticing that there was a man who needed healing. And this man, I want you to notice, was silent. He wasn't flagging Jesus down for help. Instead, Jesus goes to the man with the withered hand and welcomes him to the table. Jesus uses his privilege to make room at the table back then. And our hope is that part of our growing in faith will include all of us, using our privilege, whatever it is, our agency, whatever we have, our identities, wherever we are, as baptized Christian people, to extend God's love to all of God's children. All means all. And may we follow this example that Jesus gave us this day and every day. Amen.
Wondering where I might begin, hear a voice upon the wind. She's singing faint, but singing true. Son, there ain't nothing you can do, but listen close and follow me. I'll take you where you're meant to be. Just don't lose faith. So I put my hand upon the plow, wipe the sweat up from my brow, plant the good seed along the way, as I look forward to the day when at last I see my Father run to me, singing, oh my child, come on home. Home to me, and I will hold you in my arms, and joyful be there will always, always be a place for you at my table. Return to me, come on home, home to me, and I will hold you in my arms, and joyful be there will always, always be a place for you at my table, at my table. Return to